Namaste. Good evening. So we begin chapter 2 tonight. Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. Because each aspect of the divine reality has a concordant power expressive of it. He again begins with wonderful citations drawn from the Vedantic tradition. In this case, nothing is taken from the Rig Veda, but we have the Gita, the Taittiriya Upanishad, Shvetashvatara Upanishad as the primary sources. The first, it is there in beings, indivisible, and as if divided, avibhaktam chabhuteshu vibhaktam. Brahman, the truth, satyam, the knowledge, jnanam, the infinite, anantam. That is from the Taittiriya Upanishad. The third is from the Gita. Know Purusha and Prakriti to be both eternal without beginning, anadi. The fourth is from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. One must know Vidhi, Maya as Prakriti, and the master of Maya, Mayanam, as the great Lord of all, Maheshwaram. And the last also is from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. It is the might, Mahima, of the Godhead, Devasya, in the world that turns the wheel of Brahman, Brahma Chakra. Him one must know, the Supreme Lord of all Lords, Tam Ishvaranam Paramam Maheshwaram, the Supreme Godhead above all Godheads. Supreme too is his Shakti, and manifold the natural working of her knowledge and her force. Supreme Shakti Parasya Shaktir, her knowledge Jnana, and her force Bala. One Godhead, Eko Deva, occult in all beings, the inner self, Atman of all beings, the all-pervading, absolute Kevala, without qualities, Nirguna, the overseer of all actions, the witness, Sakshi, the knower, Cheta. We'll see these passages reverberate in many of the paragraphs that we encounter in this 40-odd page chapter. This is one of a half dozen longest chapters in The Life Divine. We'll be with this for a couple of months. And we start with what is, again, a convincing and unwavering affirmation that Sri Aurobindo is a realist. The universe is a genuine manifestation of a real conscious being who conceives all in truth, expresses all as delight. So this first sentence is almost aphoristic. There is then a supreme reality, eternal, absolute, and infinite. Because it is absolute and infinite, it is in its essence indeterminable. It is indefinable and inconceivable by finite and defining mind. It is ineffable by a mind-created speech. It is describable neither by our negations, neti, neti, For we cannot limit it by saying, it is not this, it is not that, nor by our affirmations. For we cannot fix it by saying, it is this, it is that, iti, iti. And yet, though in this way unknowable to us, it is not altogether and in every way unknowable. It is self-evident to itself, and although inexpressible, yet self-evident to a knowledge by identity of which the spiritual being in us must be capable. For that spiritual being is in its essence and its original and intimate reality not other than this supreme existence. The idea that conscious being manifests itself and you can say enters into it, although all exists within its own nature, yet fills it to the brim and knows it by identity. This is real knowledge. This is the very foundation of a truth consciousness, that all occurs within oneself. There is no partition of the being. And that means then that a perfect knowledge unites, does not divide even when it knows aspects of itself. It knows its empowerments as expressions of its own being. This knowledge by identity is core to the spiritual being that is in us. It is essential to us, and our essential truth is drawn from that supreme existence. So in a summary way, Sri Aurobindo has again united all of existence. And we'll see that in this chapter, he takes the Vedantic teachings to the farthest reaches, uniting what seem to be opposites in perspective, insisting on an overarching unity. He continues, but although thus indeterminable to mind, because of its absoluteness and infinity, we discover that this supreme and eternal infinite determines itself to our consciousness in the universe by real and fundamental truths of its being, which are beyond the universe and in it, and are the very foundation of its existence. Now, in the last chapter, the first of the second book, he called these the spiritual determinants of the absolute existence. Here he's calling them the real and fundamental truths of its being, which are beyond the universe. So there's a transcendence from which this universe comes, and it is the foundation of all. He continues, these truths present themselves to our conceptual cognition as the fundamental aspects in which we see and experience the omnipresent reality. So we are individuals looking back, and what we would experience is this fundamental truth, and discover ultimately that all reality is one, that this reality is omnipresent. If we can say that only the transcendent exists, then there is no present. But if there is a universe, then it is omnipresent, because it is stationed throughout the universe while existing beyond the universe. The universe inheres in it and coheres because of it. In themselves, he says, they are seized, he's talking about these fundamental aspects, they are seized directly, not by intellectual understanding, but by a spiritual intuition, a spiritual experience in the very substance of our consciousness. But they can also be caught at in conception by a large and plastic idea, and can be expressed in some sort by a plastic speech which does not insist too much on rigid definition or limit the wideness and subtlety of the idea. He is not looking for a well-honed mathematical concept here. He's looking for something which is large and capable of giving embodiment to the idea, giving powerful suggestion to the idea as it's uttered, as it's evoked. In order to express this experience or this idea with any nearness, a language has to be created, which is at once intuitively metaphysical and revealingly poetic, admitting significant and living images as the vehicle of a close, suggestive, and vivid indication. A language such as we find hammered out into a subtle and pregnant massiveness in the Veda and the Upanishads. Because there we find the capacity for mythic imagination to enter into a philosophic utterance that captures powerfully and movingly an image, a thought that awakens in us something which is kindred to the reality that it symbolizes. Remember, Sri Aurobindo is writing philosophy here, but he is a poet first. And so to be able to express in this significant form truths which are beyond the tongue's telling is the very domain of the poet. And if his language is beautiful, it is also rich and significant. I find in Sri Aurobindo the equal to anything that we find in the Upanishads. So again, he's talking about a spiritual intuition, a vision, a spiritual experience, which is thrown into this language and capturing something of its utterness, even though it can't be determinative about what the indeterminable is. It captures something of it and says, it is, itti, itti. But always that reality remains free. Neti, neti, na iti, na iti. It's not this, it's not that. We can say it is this, it is that, but we have to realize what we mean by that. In the ordinary tongue of metaphysical thought, we have to be content with a distant indication, an approximation by abstractions, which may still be of some service to our intellect, for it is this kind of speech which suits our method of logical and rational understanding. But if it is to be of real service, the intellect must consent to pass out of the bounds of a finite logic and accustom itself to the logic of the infinite. This will become a familiar phrase to us. And we find that he uses it also in Savitri, in book one of that great epic poem. The logic of the infinite, which surpasses the finite logic of the ratiocinative philosopher. On this condition alone, by this way of seeing and thinking, it ceases to be paradoxical or futile to speak of the ineffable, that which cannot be expressed. But if we insist on applying a finite logic to the infinite, the omnipresent reality will escape us, and we shall grasp instead an abstract shadow, a dead form petrified into speech, or a hard, incisive graph, which speaks of the reality but does not express it. Our way of knowing must be appropriate to that which is to be known. Otherwise, we achieve only a distant speculation, a figure of knowledge, and not veritable knowledge. So, by implication, the language used to express the spiritual experience and intuition should evoke what it expresses. So that language should compellingly draw to us the reality that it signifies, and hence the utility of using great words, illuminated sentences, mantric passages, such as we find in Savitri, as means of yoga itself. The supreme truth aspect, which thus manifests itself to us, is an eternal and infinite and absolute self-existence, self-awareness, self-delight of being. This founds all things and secretly supports and pervades all things. This idea of the founding reality and the immanent reality goes back to these passages that we looked at the top of this chapter, the Taittiriya Upanishad, Bhagavad Gita, Shvetashvatara. But also self-existence, self-awareness, self-delight. So again, the affirmation of Satchit Ananda. This self-existence reveals itself again in three terms of its essential nature: self, conscious being or spirit, and God, or the divine being. The Indian terms are more satisfactory. Brahman, the reality, is Atman. Purusha, Ishvara. For these terms grew from a root of intuition, and while they have a comprehensive preciseness, are capable of a plastic application which avoids both vagueness in the use and the rigid snare of a too limiting intellectual concept. So, in the last chapter, these were discussed as aspects. Here again, they're presented. Atman is self, Purusha is conscious being, Ishvara is the Lord or Master of that which is manifest, indwelling and yet sovereign. The Supreme Brahman is that which, in Western metaphysics, is called the Absolute. But Brahman is at the same time the omnipresent reality in which all that is relative exists as its forms or its movements. This is an absolute which takes all relativities in its embrace. So it's not a stark absolute divorced from the universe. It is an absolute that dwells in all things that pass. I believe I have borrowed that from Sri Aurobindo. The Upanishads affirm that all this is the Brahman. Mind is Brahman. Life is Brahman. Matter is Brahman. So just there we see the Isha Upanishad, the Taittiriya Upanishad, addressing Vayu, the Lord of Air, of Life, it is said, O Vayu, thou art manifest Brahman. And pointing to man and beast and bird and insect, each separately is identified with the One. O Brahman, thou art this old man and boy and girl, this bird, this insect. Mundaka Upanishad, the Maitri Upanishad, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Brahman is the consciousness that knows itself in all that exists. Brahman is the force that sustains the power of God and Titan and demon, the force that acts in man and animal and the forms and energies of nature. Brahman is the Ananda, the secret bliss of existence, which is the ether of our being and without which none can breathe or live. We've gone through the Kena Upanishad now, and we're back into the Taittiriya. So this is a collection of Upanishadic insights, all studded on this one ring. Brahman is the inner soul of all. Pardon me. Brahman is the inner soul in all. It has taken a form in correspondence with each created form which it inhabits. The Lord of beings is that which is conscious in the conscious being, but he is also the conscious in inconscient things, the one who is master and in control of the many that are passive in the hands of force nature. So he is the opposite of what he seems to be in his transcendence. We think of him as this which is beyond time, and yet he enters time. We think of him as being the master of all things, and yet he becomes the subject of mastery. We think of him as being conscious, and yet he becomes things that are dull or stunned into unconsciousness. What arises from this great force can become inert. All opposites, all possibilities, all variabilities exist within this one reality. He is the timeless and time, Sri Aurobindo writes. He is space and all that is in space. He is causality and the cause and the effect. He is the thinker and his thought, the warrior and his courage, the gambler and his dice throw. All realities and all aspects and all semblances are the Brahman. Brahman is the absolute, the transcendent, and incommunicable. The supracosmic existence that sustains the cosmos, the cosmic self that upholds all beings, but it is too the self of each individual. The soul or psychic entity is an eternal portion of the Ishvara. It is his supreme nature or consciousness force that has become the living being in a world of living beings. So again, he depicts the transcendent, the universal, and the individual, all as manifestations of this supreme Brahman. Our individuality is drawn from that supreme personality. So there is a truth in us which is real. And when the ego shouts out that I'm the greatest, it cannot be so, because this is one ego against all others. But there is a verity inside, because that supreme personality indwells in that manifest individual. But that realizes that its real self is one with all other selves. And if anything, there is a chorus of awakened beings which one day shall sing that, yes, we too are that supreme. And it won't be a cry of the ego. It will be a cry of exaltation, of self-discovery. The Brahman alone is, and because of it all are, for all are the Brahman. This reality is the reality of everything that we see in self and nature. Brahman, the Ishvara, is all this by his yoga maya, by the power of his consciousness force put out in self-manifestation. He is the conscious being, soul, spirit, purusha, and it is by his nature the force of his conscious self-existence, that he is all things. He is the Ishwara, the omniscient and omnipotent all-ruler, and it is by his Shakti, his conscious power, that he manifests himself in time and governs the universe. These and similar statements taken together are all comprehensive. It is possible for the mind to cut and select, to build a closed system, and explain away all that does not fit within it, but it is on the complete and many-sided statement that we must take our stand if we have to acquire an integral knowledge. So here he is bringing all of these things together in his synthetic mastery. Brahman, the Ishvara. Brahman, the reality. So Brahman, the Ishvara, is all this by his yoga maya. So here, two things are combined. Brahman, expressing itself as Ishvara, uses the yoga maya, his self-limiting and restraining conscious power. Yoga, that which controls, restrains, reaches into, draws all into oneness, but also that which is able to compress itself. Maya, the limiting power, the defining power of the infinite, to compress the infinite into a finite shape and not lose the infinite thereby. We have conscious being, Purusha, paired with nature, Prakriti, and we have Ishvara paired with Shakti. So we have the triplicity that begins this chapter, Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, now with that which accords itself in universal presentation. And of course, there are varying philosophical schools, all within the general rubric, underneath the general rubric of Vedanta, who take different positions regarding each of these postures of this great supreme reality. They all distinguish themselves vehemently from the other schools. Each says only it is correct. Sri Aurobindo, attempting a Purna Vedanta, a Purna Advaita, insists on a non-dualism which folds into it all manifestation of universe, but the reality of the individual too. He's not saying simply that the universe is real, but the individual is a real self as well. He continues, an absolute, eternal, and infinite self-existence, self-awareness, self-delight of being that secretly supports and pervades the universe, even while it is also beyond it, is then the first truth of spiritual experience. But this truth of being has at once an impersonal and a personal aspect. It is not only existence, it is the one being, absolute, eternal, and infinite. So again, he's described self-existence, self-awareness, self-delight, which is Sat-Chit-Ananda. And he says that it is both impersonal and personal. Well, the concept, again, of Sat-Chit-Ananda comes from theistic Vedanta, roughly, let's say, 1,000 years old, and we find the concept specifically spoken of in the Virasena Tapaniya Upanishad, the Muktika Upanishad, the Vasudeva, Ramottara Tapani. So these are the oldest sources, and then from there, going out greatly. As there are three fundamental aspects in which we meet this reality, self, conscious being, or spirit and God, the divine being, or to use the Indian terms, the absolute and omnipresent reality, Brahman, manifest to us as Atman, Purusha, Ishvara, So too, its power of consciousness appears to us in three aspects. It is the self-force of that consciousness, conceptively creative of all things, Maya. It is Prakriti, nature or force, made dynamically executive, working out all things under the witnessing eye of the conscious being, the self or spirit. It is the conscious power of the divine being, Shakti, which is both conceptively creative and dynamically executive of all the divine workings. So you can see the interplay of each facet leaning one into the other, perhaps the most complete, the idea of the Ishwaran Shakti. These three aspects and their powers base and comprise the whole of existence and all nature. And taken together as a single whole, they reconcile the apparent disparateness and incompatibility of the supracosmic transcendence, the cosmic universality, and the separativeness of our individual existence. The absolute cosmic nature and ourselves are linked in oneness by this triune aspect of the one reality. For taken by itself, the existence of the Absolute, the Supreme Brahman, would be a contradiction of the relative universe, and our own real existence would be incompatible with its sole incommunicable reality. But the Brahman is, at the same time, omnipresent in all relativities. It is the Absolute, independent of all relatives, the Absolute basing all relatives, the Absolute governing, pervading, constituting all relatives. There is nothing that is not the omnipresent reality. In observing the triple aspect and the triple power, we come to see how this is possible. So this dynamism inheres in conscious being, which expresses itself universally, individually, in all stadia of becoming, without losing its rapt status in the transcendent. Well, I think we've made a good beginning for the evening. And we'll turn to Savitri for a fitting close to our study together tonight. This is taken from the Book of the Divine Mother, Book 3. This is in the first canto, The Pursuit of the Unknowable. The demiurges lost their names and forms. The great schemed worlds that they had planned and wrought passed, taken and abolished one by one. The universe removed its colored veil, and at the unimaginable end of the huge riddle of created things appeared the far-seen Godhead of the whole, his feet firm based on life's stupendous wings, omnipotent, a lonely seer of time, inward, inscrutable, with diamond gaze. Attracted by the unfathomable regard, the unsolved slow cycles to their fount returned to rise again from that invisible sea. All from his puissance born was now undone. Nothing remained the cosmic mind conceives. Eternity prepared to fade and seemed a hue and imposition on the void, Space was the fluttering of a dream that sank before its ending into nothing's deeps. The spirit that dies not, and the Godhead self, seemed myths projected from the unknowable. From it all sprang, in it is called to seize. But what that was, no thought nor sight could tell. Only a formless form of self was left, a tenuous ghost of something that had been, the last experience of a lapsing wave before it sinks into a bornless sea, as if it kept, even on the brink of naught, its bare feeling of the ocean whence it came. A vastness brooded free from sense of space, an everlastingness cut off from time, a strange, sublime, inalterable peace, silent, rejected from it world and soul, a stark, companionless reality, answered at last to his soul's passionate search. Passionless, wordless, absorbed in its fathomless hush, keeping the mystery none would ever pierce, it brooded inscrutable and intangible, facing him with its dumb, tremendous calm. It had no kinship with the universe. There was no act, no movement in its vast. Life's question, met by its silence, died on her lips. The world's effort ceased, convicted of ignorance, finding no sanction of supernal light. There was no mind there with its need to know. There was no heart there with its need to love. All person perished in its namelessness. There was no second. It had no partner or peer. Only itself was real to itself. A pure existence, safe from thought and mood, a consciousness of unshared immortal bliss, it dwelt aloof in its bare infinite, one and unique, unutterably soul. A being formless, featureless, and mute, that knew itself by its own timeless self, aware forever in its motionless depths, uncreating, uncreated, and unborn, the one by whom all live, who lives by none, an immeasurable luminous secrecy, guarded by the veils of the unmanifest, above the changing cosmic interlude, abode supreme, immutably the same, a silent cause, occult, impenetrable, infinite, eternal, unthinkable, alone. That's the end of Canto 1. In Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother. So, Namaste. Jai Ma.